Fremd vertraut, der Podcast der Evangelischen Akademie zu internationaler Politik, Dialog und Vielfalt. Welcome to a new edition of Fremd vertraut, this time in English. My name is Jürgen Klusmann and I'm presenting you Voices of Eastern Europe. From October 9 to 16, I was in the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius, where I met three interesting people from three different countries to discuss the Russian invasion in Ukraine from a common Eastern European perspective. The journalist Andrei Zayakin from Russia, the Ukrainian sociologist and anthropologist Andrei Vaziano, and the historian Lorianas Paloditis from Vilnius. But let's start having them introducing themselves.
My name is Andrei Zayakin. I come from Russia originally. I am physicist by education. I worked in several European universities doing string theories and quantum chromodynamics. In 2013, I started together with my friends from academia and journalism the project called Dissernet that has been studying the dissertations of Russian public persons. I have worked in investigative journalism. I worked in Nova Gazeta for a long time, and now I work for the investigative media portal The Insider.
My name is Andrei Vazyanov, or Andrei Vaziano. These are correspondingly Ukrainian and Belarusian version of my name. I'm originally coming from the city of Mariupol in the east of Ukraine, but from a mixed family, so strangely enough, I have Belarusian citizenship and I'm connected to both countries. I'm social anthropologist by training. I hold my PhD degree from University of Regensburg, Germany, and I did my field work in Romania and then Ukraine and then Belarus. It was about urban infrastructures and Europeanization. Since 2020, I'm focusing on topics related to mass repressions in case of Belarus. Since 2022, I'm living in Lithuania. I'm teaching at European Humanities University.
Thank you. My name is Lorianas Paloditis. I'm a lecturer at Vilnius University. My two primary fields of research and what I teach is history of ideas and concepts and also political philosophy. So I've always been interested both in the theoretical but also the practical side of politics. I come from Vilnius, so naturally I will be presenting the Baltic perspective on the issues we're discussing.
This talk was at the beginning of my 6 days trip to the Baltics. My aim was to find out what people from Central and Eastern European countries think about the Russian invasion in Ukraine and how they analyze the activities of Russia and the European Union. Moreover, I wanted to know about the feelings and the personal impressions and what has changed for them after the war has begun. We met in my hotel room in the old city of Vilnius, where I had built up my podcast equipment I brought with me, and we started talking. The first who gave an answer was the Russian journalist Andrei Zayakin.
Everything has changed. More specifically, the thing that had changed for me personally was the degree of my naivety. Before the full-scale war began, I had the false notion of some rudiments, some remnants of rationality and humanity that may have resided with Putin's regime. It was, of course, completely wrong and completely naive. And I think this was the main change that I felt from the beginning of the full-scale invasion.
It is possible to talk endlessly about the changes occurring after the start of the full-scale Russian invasion into Ukraine, but I will try to summarize it in 3 points. The first point is physical destruction. Many cities and towns and villages in Ukraine are destroyed, Also, many nature areas are destroyed or transformed. My home city of Mariupol is not existing in the previous physical form. An island of Jeralgach, where I spent summer 2021, is not an island anymore, and it was transformed into peninsula by Russian military technique. The second point is mobility, because the war has, on the one hand, forced so many people to leave their homes, but then it had limited possibilities of people to choose where they want to stay and where they want to go. For me, this limitation started in 2020 because I had to flee from repressions from Belarus, and I fled from Minsk to Kiev. And I was able to go to Mariupol in 2021 to visit my family. After the start of the full-scale invasion, I cannot go neither to Belarus nor to Russia, and it is difficult for me to go to Ukraine with my passport. I succeeded to go there three times as a volunteer since February 2022. That's what we did with other Belarusian citizens. But also it is very important to mention that Ukrainian men cannot leave their country because of martial law. So there is a ban on leaving the country. No one knows when this ban will be lifted because it's completely related to the war. And the third point here is injustice. I think the war is incredible stress for bureaucratic and academic and other institutions on the national and on international level. Not always there are adequate responses, and a large number of people are facing the restrictions that are consequences of decisions they have never taken. Some of these restrictions do not help Ukraine to win. Many of these restrictions are unprecedented because many countries, both in Europe and outside Europe, has never faced such circumstances. So it's basically not known what to do. Yeah, there was nothing like this for many decades.
Thank you.
There is the personal perspective and there is the more sort of general collective perspective. So personally, for me, my perceptions have not changed that much since February 2022, because already Lithuania was very attentive to what was Russia doing in Ukraine since 2014, the occupation of Crimea, the starting the war in eastern regions of Ukraine, but also in 2020, the quashing of the Belarusian revolution in the summer of 2020 happened with Russian intervention. So there's this strong geopolitical tension felt since, because we have refugees and people from Belarus, from Ukraine. Of course, there's people who are political exiles who come to Lithuania, to Poland, to other countries from Russia as well. So there's an influx of people, which is, of course, in Vilnius, in the capital, it's naturally felt. And also what we can say that the anxiety, the sort of tension on the one side is felt because of the general security situation and the militarization of Russian society and its regime. But also on the other side, there is felt a great deal of empathy, especially towards Ukrainians in Ukraine. There's a lot of fundraising activity going on to help both the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian civilians who are also suffering various challenges and hardships right now.
Whereas Andrei Zayakin gave a very personal answer, making clear that his world had more or less completely collapsed, the Ukrainian sociologist Andrei Vazianov focused more on what the war means not only to him, but for his hometown and his countrymen. On the other hand, Lurianas Paluditis, the Lithuanian participant, gave a rather different answer to my question. Since Lithuania is a NATO member, he looked at the war from another perspective. His remarks mirrored the perception of a country that has been part of the Soviet Union, but now is a member of the free world and enjoys the relative security of being a member of the biggest defense alliance in the world. Next, I wanted to know what expectations they have when thinking about the future and the coming developments, not only for their countries, but for the whole region and the whole of Europe.
I think it's very bad taste to predict the future. without being a Nostradamus of some kind. But the thing that can be stated is that if Ukraine doesn't win, we're going to live in hell for I don't know how many years. I don't mean myself personally, I mean the whole of Europe. 50 years, maybe 100 years. So the change that was made by this aggression is really catastrophic. And the only way to overcome it is to help Ukraine win.
I agree with Andrei that it is not the best solution to try to forecast something. Social sciences also always say we do not predict the future. But we can look at some trends that are manifesting themselves recently. And one of the trends is that many people are not sure where they're going to live and where they want to live even. So people are facing displacement, they're facing uncertainty. It is uncertainty both of geopolitical and bureaucratic kind, sometimes of economic kind. And we can say for sure there are a lot of demographic changes now ongoing in region. Then the second thing is disappointment. There are so many people who are disappointed and who change their views and who think that they have been naive and that they have not been radical enough and so on. Once again, we don't know where this change of identities and views and plans will lead to, but the planning or ability to plan was an important part of culture in many, many countries. And I think people feel now that they are devoid of the future in the sense that they cannot even imagine it, and correspondingly, they cannot plan it. It's going to bring profound cultural change, I think.
Well, it's what I want or what I think is possible. They're a little bit different. But starting from the optimistic perspective, I think, yes. Right now, we're in a very precarious position. All of Eastern and Central Europe, you could say, in terms of safety on many levels, not only of military kind, but also the humanitarian situation, the discourse on refugees, human rights, on what we consider our main priorities and challenges in terms of economics, energy security, and so on. There's a lot of things going on, but the optimist in me would hope that Ukraine wins, and this helps to bring a more, first of all, more stable peace to Ukraine, something sustainable that it could start rebuilding, and that's very important, but also that the military defeat of the Russian regime would bring about at least some kind of window of opportunity of change, let's say, in Russia, that would allow other countries also like Belarus, like Georgia, to reestablish their sovereignty to the levels, at least to what it was prior to the 2020s, but hopefully even to move forward. So we're in a very, you know, precarious position where there's very many opportunities of how this could end well, even though there's already a very high price and we already understand there's no easy way to end the war. There's no easy way, even when the shooting stops on the front lines, to deal with the consequences, because a lot of people are traumatized. A lot of people lost their homes, lost their families, lost social connections, and a lot of dramatic things have already happened. And we cannot sort of rewind back, which I think was a very strong mindset at the start of the war. If the war stops now, we can sort of roll back maybe to the status quo entente. So that's now gone. So now we have to focus moving forward. The pessimistic scenario, I think, would be long-lasting stalemate. Ukraine does not regain its territorial integrity. The war sort of drags on with moments of intensifying and cooling down. There's no official peace or ceasefire. Only, you know, sort of low-level technical ceasefire agreements are possible, both from legal point and also from the political point of view. But also this opens, you know, another set of opportunities is the dangers, because as we can see now, the Russian regime and military-industrial complex, as we can say, has moved into the sort of on the path of mobilization of all the resources it has available to the military effort. if there is no way to vent all of that energy, it creates dangers we don't know for whom. Maybe in the Baltics, maybe in the Caucasus, maybe for Kazakhstan. It's very hard to predict what could unfold. So yes, I would agree that Ukraine's victory comes first as the main set of priorities, and only then we can start to look beyond that horizon to the opportunities that will open by then. But seeing to a much farther future right now is, I think, also very, very problematic. So my expectations, the pessimist would see we have a real big danger of going into a stalemate, which drags on, which drains resources, which is very bad for people's emotional, psychological health, for morale, you could say. But the optimistic scenario, of course, if we concentrate enough, if we give all the right help, all the right tools to Ukrainian society, to Ukrainian military, of course, they win the war, they reclaim back their country, and then there's a sort of horizon of opportunities of optimism, not only for countries in the Baltic, but all around the neighboring countries and peoples.
Whereas the three completely matched that Ukraine has to win this war because the alternative would be further destabilization of other Eastern European countries, I confronted them with the perspective of many people in Germany. They believe that the Russian invasion into Ukraine was provoked by NATO eastward expansion. They claim that Russia had no other alternative since the West, in their words, planned to destabilize Russia. The answers of the three were very clearly.
This is typical bullshit that's been distributed by Putin's propaganda outlets. So I'm not a professor of history to start a long lecture of disproving this obviously false statement. I would just point out for your listeners, no, not from Russia, that those who earnestly repeat this bullshit just don't understand Putin at all. I don't claim to understand him. I'm not his psychiatrist and I'm not his confessing father. From his actions and from his statements, it's clear that he doesn't care for NATO at all. But he definitely does care for total Vernichtung,
for this
destruction of Ukraine, because he doesn't believe it's a state. I have spent a lot of time within the Dissernet community reading the works of Mr. Medinsky. Maybe your listeners must know better who Mr. Medinsky is. Mr. Medinsky, as he styles himself, Dr. Medinsky, is Putin's court historian. He doesn't have an education of historian. He was originally a politologist or something like that, but he decided one day to become historian, and he wrote a habilitation thesis on history without having gone through bachelor, master, or PhD studies in history. This habilitation thesis was just absolute bullshit. And we at Dissernet spent a lot of time in connecting the professional community of historians, philologists, and connecting them with activists in our persons, so that Mr. Medinsky's habilitation thesis be revoked. And we almost won. Just think of it. In Putin's Russia, we got a verdict from the topmost professional body of historians who are appointed by the state to consider appeals against doctoral thesis. So we got the verdict saying that Mr. Medinsky's thesis is a piece of bullshit. It's very well known, again, you're welcome to look it up somewhere, that Mr. Medinsky is the person who writes down for Putin his historical speeches and articles, and who, on broader terms, puts into Putin's head the historical stupidities that Putin is thinking. So, as I said, I don't have a tomography to look into Putin's head, but for some reasons, we do know that it's Mr. Medinsky who is concocting the hellish narratives that Putin is spitting out. And we know these narratives very well. These narratives are that Ukraine does not exist, must not exist, and will not exist. Period. Forget about NATO. He doesn't give a shit for NATO at all. It's a great pity for me, and it's another question pertinent to our discussion, that NATO has not invited Ukraine to join. But it's, as I said, a completely different story. Just focus on Putin's mind. We know from a lot of journalistic and academic studies who are those people into Putin's head, the rubbish that comes out. One of them, and one of the most important ones, is Medinsky. And a huge part of my professional life, some 6 or 7 years ago, was dedicated to investigating this guy and to disproving his doctoral thesis and to revoking his doctoral title.
Andrei Zayakin referred in his answer to Vladimir Medinsky, a Russian politician who was Minister of Culture from 2012 to 2020. He resigned after the scandal about his doctoral thesis. Ironically, he was appointed as the head of the Russian delegation in the negotiation between Ukraine and Russia in 2022. Of course, that's an exciting fact that we in the Western world don't even have on our radar.
To put it shortly, I disagree with the theory that Russia has been provoked by any other state or military alliance. And it's important to remember that before Russia has started the full-scale invasion in February 2022, there has been not a single violation of territorial integrity of Russian Federation done by other independent states. There were no soldiers of other states. There were no missiles and bombs from other states flying into Russian territory. I think it is more than enough to disagree with the theory.
Thank you.
Well, I think this narrative that Russia somehow provoked connects to another narrative, which is concerning what happened after the end of the Cold War. The political narrative of the current Russian military and political elite is that Russia was somehow humiliated, it was beaten down by the collective West and so on. And when actually, if we look at the historical record, it's the direct opposite. Russia was accommodated at every step of the way. Let's not provoke them, let's be gentle. They're having a difficult period right now. We shouldn't be very harsh on them, on how they should reform and so on. And knowing, I think, a little bit about the psychology of people who in the Russian military elite and how they are thinking, the only thing they are provoked by is weakness, or what they perceive as weakness. If you bend over backwards and you're not seen as a threat, you will not be considered who should be feared, respect, and to be considered in regard as a threat. Russia never intended to start a war with NATO because it is afraid that it would be beaten soundly. And then there will be the question what happens next and what happens then. But also, if we look at the Russian political elite and where they keep all the money they have stolen from Russian citizens and from colonial practices inside of the sort of socio-political Russian structure, they're keeping all that money in Western countries, in real estate, you know, banks, companies, and so on. So you do not keep your assets in countries you're planning to nuke. That's just not how that works. But the narrative of somehow provoking Russia is, again, that Russia, especially Putin, tries to, on the one hand, present itself as being this macho, strong, anti-woke, kind of masculine civilization. And on the other hand, they are somehow always treated unfairly, always the victim, trying to blend these two narratives together. Also, if you look from a rational point of view, it does not work. But if you look from an emotional point of view, you could see how these sentiments could combine in certain ways. But another thing is, if we look at the facts concerning NATO, what so-called NATO expansion, NATO does not expand. Countries ask to join NATO. They're presented with a sort of membership action plan. First of all, even to be considered a future member of NATO. But then when the joining process is also very, very complicated, because if one country is saying, no way are we going to accept you, you will not join NATO. So that's one thing. And if we look at the historical record, exactly 2008, there was a clear sign from the European elites to the Russian elites that we will never accept Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. The Bucharest summit. It's very well documented and is the exact situation that he said, no, we'll not accept Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And next thing happens is the war between Russia and Georgia. And after that, the escalation with Ukraine, which culminates in 2014 and then 2022. But how it's presented, dared to consider the fact that Ukraine might join NATO, so that's why they're starting the war. If Ukraine had joined NATO, it's very complicated because they probably would not even fulfill at that time the requirements. But if Ukraine had joined somehow NATO before the war, there would be no war. That's the only truth you can say.
It was somewhat surprising for me how united my conversation partners were in their clear condemnation of this narrative. So I confronted them with another story that is going around in Germany. It refers to the time of the German reunification when the Soviet Union was still existing and Gorbachev was in power. At that time, there was a meeting between him and the former Chancellor Kohl and other Western leaders, and they were talking about the future. Gorbachev expressed his fears that if Germany would be reunited, NATO would also expand further into Eastern Europe. But following that story, Chancellor Kohl and the others promised him that it would never happen. But after the breakdown of the USSR, this promise was broken by the West. Once again, my conversation partners were very clearly in their statements.
I would advise people who tell this story to refer to a document. What doesn't exist in a document doesn't exist. There are lots of stories circulating in the Russian internet, for example, about Mrs. Madeleine Albright willing to decimate Russians. I don't remember the exact story. When we look at the sources of this story, it comes out to be something like a spiritic seance conducted somewhere in an institute that formerly belonged to KGB or something like that. All these stories need some kind of documental proof. Irrespective of whether this can or cannot be a casus belli, there is nothing to consider.
Exactly. The Soviet Union does not exist anymore. One thing. After 1991, Russia, well, it sort of joined the international legal and political system, and it promised to respect the redrawn previous borders according to the Acts of Helsinki, which are also a very important part of especially Western European political system in general. And another thing is, just in general, no one was, even if such a conversation had happened and it would be documented, no one had the authority to make such a promise. Because especially in Central and Eastern Europe, we have a very bad history concerning Germany and Moscow making arrangements. I'm talking about, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. For anyone, for example, if you would say for anyone in Poland, well, Berlin and Moscow have decided, and they would say, we really do not care because it's not your decision to make for a sovereign democratic country. So that's the sort of short response to that, adding to what my colleague said.
At that point of our discussion, I realized that there was still another issue which plays a major role in the German debate on the war. And again, I wanted to know what the three were thinking of it. It is the argument that diplomatic efforts to solve the conflict are not sufficient, and neither the German Chancellor Scholz nor any other European leader would have undertaken sufficient initiatives to talk to the Russian President Putin. Moreover, this argument says that the US administration would even undermine such efforts to prolong the war.
The Germans should really better read Goethe's Faust, make notice that it doesn't have any sense to make pacts with the devil. I must remind your listeners that even in Goethe's narrative, the devil deceived Faust, so he didn't really give him eternal youth. He's blind by the end of the book, and then devil keeps deceiving him. And, for example, when Faust orders some huge constructions changing the whole world, the small devils are just digging out a grave for him. And it's only a miracle that saves the guy, and If you look into the so-called People's Book of Faust stories, you'll see that everything actually ends much worse for the guy. So you never ever should make pacts with the devil. He never pays respect to your words and to his own words.
Also, I think that in Western context, the statement that the diplomatic effort was not sufficient is a statement of comfort. That's what people want to believe in. It is also very uncomfortable for me as a person from Ukraine or Belarus to see that diplomatic way is not possible anymore. Of course, we all would want diplomacy instead of full-scale war. And speaking about changes and disappointments, I think this is one of the largest disappointments in many populations living next to Russia. The disappointment caused by own optimism. We all were thinking it is possible to live peacefully with any kind of neighbor, and then it turned out to be impossible. Now it is important to understand that what people say in countries that don't have a border with Russia is not what they believe in, but probably what they want to be true. And there is a notion of discourse. What we say is not always what we mean literally. Yeah, so we have to read sometimes between the lines. And we also have to read between the lines and those statements about diplomacy. I think much more people are aware of impossibility of diplomacy in this very case, but some people just do not say it aloud.
Continuing the theme, diplomacy needs at least of minimum trust that the deal will be held up. There's no prerequisites to suppose any such idea right now. But also, in generally, if we would look what the Russian diplomat corpus was doing right before the war, the outrageous claims they were making and the way they were behaving, which was what the diplomats from all the world would say, well, that's not how you behave as a diplomat. We've drawn themselves from the sort of broader diplomatic structure. And there are no indications. Let's even suppose a diplomatic solution of any kind is possible. Where do we begin? But the thing is, we have no signals from Russia that even if Ukraine, with Europe, with the United States of America, would reach out and say, okay, let's sit down at the table and talk. There is no signals that Russia wants to talk. And of course, if we look at the record when President Zelensky was elected, he was elected on the platform of, okay, let's make a deal with Moscow, let's make a deal with Putin, sit me down in a room, we will talk this out. And they met, it was a disaster, and it became absolutely clear that Vladimir Putin or his minister Lavrov or whoever they sent has no intention of really talking about anything. So if there is no intention to talk, can we even suggest that we have a diplomatic solution open? It might open down the road somewhere, when they're, you know, facing a clear military defeat, then they will be probably quite open to any kind of deal. But also, should you take that deal? That's a very big question. That might be another grave mistake, so not to see this through. Even though it's very painful for a lot of people, people are losing their lives daily, war crimes are committed daily and systemically, so this is very painful, but also ending this war, since it has done so much damage, so much pain, we have the sort of moral and political obligation, I think, as Western countries, Europe, European Union and NATO, to help Ukraine fulfill what their aim is. And their aim is ending the war on their terms.
At this point, I realized what it means to be a real victim of the war and how painful it was for them that so many hopes for a peaceful development had been disappointed. But still, I wanted to know if they believed if there were no alternatives to military actions. Andriy Zayakin's answer to that happened to be rather sarcastic.
There is an alternative that aliens come to the Kremlin and take Putin, Medinsky, and maybe some dozen of people more to Mars or Venus.
May I share an insight that a friend of mine has shared to me? And this friend of mine is living in Russia. He claims to not support the war, but what he observed is that people are finding existential senses and money in going to war or in contributing to war. So a relative of his is working at a factory that pretended to produce agrarian technique, combines, but now is working also for military industry. The phenomenon of culture that he's describing is that being in a state of war is a part of normality. Most probably, the war is not the single part of this normality. And then, as social scientists, we have to figure out what are the other foundations of this normality so that probably we could somehow change the rules for those people inside that ideology or inside that cultural phenomena of normalized war. Yeah, so to make the life of the people abnormal in a way, how to say, might be a way to change their mind. But of course, the violent unmaking of normality is not what one would recommend, is not what one would say aloud. Yeah, but we are not even sure that having your home city bombed is not a part of such normality. There are Russian cities that are hit with missiles today. Belgorod, for instance, and still many people do not see it as something not normal. So that's a tragic observation, and this is something that we have to face with. It is not only a question of direct violence, and many worldviews will not be changed with direct violence. And this is a question of what will happen after this war will end. Will people change also their mind, or they will only change their windows that have been destroyed by missiles?
I would probably be a pessimist when it comes to what is happening right now in Russian society in general, the way a large strata of it has not only aligned itself ideologically, but is, you know, actively participating in the military effort through military service, but also working in the military industry and supporting in through the bureaucratic apparatus. And there's a lot of people involved, and for them to somehow change their perspective and change their mind, I don't think this is very likely, and we can count on it. But another sort of non-military way out of it would probably be a painful economic and societal collapse of the Russian state. So it means running out of money, running out of certain resources. We see that they're using up the war chest that Putin and his ministers have built up before this war, but they still have money left probably for go another year. Of course, they're starting to print money. There's inflation and so on. But that's another way. But also the problem is then we as Europeans, you could ask, are we committed to this path? Because yeah, we want a non-military sort of resolution to this conflict, and that way would be economic sanctions which are reinforced, which are monitored, policed, and so on. They're very hard to implement. They will not be 100% successful. I wouldn't say that the aim should be to sort of change what the Russian society thinks and so on. No, the question is, does the Russian state have the means to wage this war? From what we see now, and even Russian economists, what they are talking about, probably the Russian state has enough resources to keep going into 2024. Maybe not beyond that. Maybe they'll start to look for a sort of a semi-peace to rebuild, regain resources, and then prepare for another war. So there's also this economic and diplomatic danger. So, but if we really want non-military from the Western countries to end this, then we have to really concentrate on the economic front. And what Andriy said about making the sort of militarized state and people living in that society feel less comfortable and less normal about what's happening on around. And some things have been done to achieve that. But if you would look views of what's how people spend the summer in Moscow and St. Petersburg, there's still a lot of normality, as if the war is a colonial war somewhere far away. And even the war is more felt in capitals like Berlin or Vilnius or Warsaw.
Based on their illusionless assessments in the question of alternatives to military actions, I wanted to know next what my three conversation partners were thinking about the fact that the war was entering more and more also Russian territory, not only in the border region, but even in Moscow, and if they think that this would make a difference.
But probably, sociologically speaking, it depends on whose houses are destroyed by those drones. Every authoritarian society lives in an incredible level of indifference. So people basically do not care about each other. And I think this also is correct for Russian population, for most of it. People who are not affected by war directly do not care much or do not care at all about those people who are affected by war. As authoritarian society here, Russia is not unique. If the richest people who take the decisions and who are looking for solutions, who have important connections, if these people feel the direct effect of war, probably that would be different, because at least they care about themselves a lot. And this we know from studies of Russian rich. This is something that is empirically demonstrated. And we also mentioned even today that Russian elites want to save their money in the West. They also quite often want to send their children to the West. It all means that they at least care about own comfort. And it is important to think about this group of people then.
Well, yes, I think it's a double-edged sword when we talk about what the effects are of the sort of the piercing of the veil of perception. On the one hand, drone attacks, especially on Moscow, on the Moscow city, but before that, on the Kremlin itself. It was purely symbolic, but has symbolic value, showing that, well, actually the regime might be more fragile than it presents itself. So on the one hand, it might give a certain hope. But the more parts of Russia are affected, there is also the possibility of a sort of resentment growing. And we already, it's very hard now to measure that because we don't have reliable sociology of the Russian society. So we're pretty much in the dark here. Well, we can, you know, see what people are writing, what they're talking about, what articles they're reading and so on. But there's also a possibility that at least part of Russian society could grow resentful and, yes, it could rally around the flag. Another possibility that, well, part of the critique of what we've seen from inside Russian society and, you know, Telegram channels who are patriotic in the sort of pro-Kremlin sense, patriotic, they're critical not of the war itself, but they're critical of the fact that the war is going badly. This could also be used to our advantage, the fact that the war is really going badly, exposing how badly it's going, increasing the level of desperation and sort of instability.
Again, it was surprising to see that despite their clear stance for Ukraine, they were still worrying about new resentments among the Russians. In this context, I raised the case of Yevgeny Prigozhin, who revolted against the Russian army and was killed later on for his rebellion. I wanted to know whether they thought if this case was a demonstration of the instability of Russia.
The only mistake that he made was exactly a deal with the devil, or in this case, right, a criminal. One of the analogies that I liked about when people describe Putin, even people who have met him, is that he's a gambler. He's not a strategist, he's a gambler. And also, the specific Russian word would be shuler. It's a guy who cheats at cards. He not only gambles, but he's also a cheat. So he will always trick you. You think the game is fair, but he will always try to rig the game. So what happened to Prigozhin is very simple. He thought he had a deal, but it was stupid to think that. Of course, he is just as a war criminal as Putin himself or any high-ranking Russian military commander. He gave out orders in violation of all the military and human rights conventions. So we shouldn't romanticize Prigozhin as an alternative. It's kind of reminds of Marxist discussions about, well, if Trotsky would have won over Stalin, you know, maybe he would have killed a few million more, maybe a few million less. It's not that big of a difference. He was a greedy war criminal, but yeah, he had more maybe material interests in mind in his business and so on. It may seem sometimes that part of the Russian elite doesn't even care that much anymore, which makes them dangerous. There might be that tension between those who want to keep the money and the luxury and those who sort of converted to fascist ideology, which more concerns itself with military power and expansion.
Obviously, my conversation partners were very pessimistic concerning the war and the opportunities to end it. So my last question was about what more could be done to support Ukraine.
A lot can be done by everyone in his place, by intellectuals, by businessmen, by the media, by activists, and by simple citizens. And there are different tasks. For intellectuals, the task is to go down to the sources, as actually Dr. Faust is teaching us, to learn deeply what's going on in Russia and to disentangle the propaganda's narratives, to fight the stupidities and lies that have deeply penetrated the European society. It's a pity that actually in Germany these lies have taken really deep roots. For journalists, it's up to them to investigate war crimes of Putin's regime, to investigate the corruption crimes in the Western Europe and elsewhere. It was rightly said, all the Putin's elite consider Europe a place to hide the bloody money that they had made with bloody hands. For civil society and for activists, it's time to press upon the European governments that they give more help to Ukraine, that the governments go after Putin's bloody money and prevent other members of his clique hiding this money and using this money in Europe. Simple citizens who are not members of the media or parliament must address their MPs, their deputies. So I believe that if every European writes a letter to his member of parliament in his country immediately, offer more help to Ukraine, this would be a totally different situation from now on, which current situation I characterize by the word hypocrisy, because the European elites are betraying Ukraine by not helping it in essential way. They are letting Putin's criminals keep their money in Europe.
Yes, thank you.
I have two answers. The short one is, if we knew, we would do it all. The second answer is, if we look at the rankings showing which percentage of GDP European countries or EU countries direct to help to Ukraine, we'll see the Baltic states in top three. And these three states are not among the richest, and they are among the smallest. I'm saying this just to stress that we should not pretend that everyone in the EU does as much as they can. It remains a question whether they will find motivation. War in Ukraine affects all EU countries, but not all of them to the same extent. And it's a test for solidarity that EU also has to pass. And one small addition is that people who want to help Ukraine should have such a possibility. And here I'm referring to experiences from volunteering movement, where sometimes the restrictions actually demotivate people from help, because the volunteers turn out to be those who risk most, those who are the most precarious, those who have more troubles with documents and so on. This I'm saying particularly from Belarusian perspective, because there is considerable number of Belarusian citizens trying to volunteer in Ukraine, but then exactly they face the bureaucratic difficulties. But we could also find similar examples in other societies, when people who want to volunteer to dedicate their time and resources are not helped in this intention. So that could also be a good contribution, no one would be devoid of a right to help Ukraine in this situation?
First of all, no help is too little. If you can spare 1 euro, spare 1 euro. It's already 1 euro going for the right cause. Don't be afraid to speak out. Don't be afraid to speak your mind to your friends, to your family. Write to your member of parliament, of course, because when you're in political power or in office, getting that feedback and sort of sensing what the public opinion is very important on your decision making. But on a more broader level, I would say have hope, because the question is, do we believe in human rights, in the values of freedom, of democracy, of respecting each and every individual? If the answer is yes, I would think things are worth fighting for. And if we answer the question that, do we want to live in a free country, in a free continent, in a more free world where human rights are respected and those rights of different groups of people and minorities? This is very, very, very critical and very important. So if you believe in these things, even small, the smallest things you can do will help. And so being optimistic about it is also one thing that we must do. It's not being defeatist that, oh, we are losing and the authoritarian regimes in the world, they are so strong, they are so powerful, but we have something that is worth defending. I really believe that Europe has great things worth fighting and living for, and that's why many people from around the world come to live, want to be here, want to become part of the European fabric, to enrich with their cultures, their identities, and their experiences. If we believe in this sort of humanistic project of Europe, it's a thing that we should defend, most definitely.
It really touched me how the three were so much convinced that still a lot of things had to be done. And with this appeal to defend the humanitarian project of Europe, we ended our conversation. For me, as a Western European, it was a remarkable lecture in European history, democracy, and how strong and attractive the idea of freedom and participation still is. It is something we Westerners sometimes have to be reminded of. At least the days in Vilnius turned out to be very fruitful. It was a real pleasure and honor to talk to such great experts.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for the talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.